You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is the 28th of October 2016 and you are listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Once again today, I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Messerschmitt and Dennis Wise, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. But just before I introduce them and find out how things are going and what we're going to be talking about this week, I just have a few announcements that I'd like to make. Just to let people know that we do now have a Radio Aryan Facebook page, and that also has a player that will pop up in your browser. You can also find us on TuneIn, which is an app for mobile phones. And for American listeners, we also now have an Audio Now account, which means that you can call a phone number from any phone and then listen to Radio Aryan. So it basically means that you can use up your free minutes on your cell phone contract by listening to us. And the number for that is 641-793-9434. And you can also find that on the RadioAryan.com site. And just again, that's an American phone number. There's no subscription fee and regular calling rates apply. That's got the announcements for Radio Aryan out of the way. And I also have an announcement for an event that's taking place in Britain. The Southwest Forum will be taking place tomorrow, Saturday the 29th. All are welcome. It's going to be in the Bristol area. It starts at 1 o'clock and it will finish at 5 o'clock. And there'll also be an evening social. There'll be a buffet lunch, merchandise stalls and raffle. And the speakers there are going to be Richard Edmonds, who I'm sure people have heard of before, longtime British nationalist and supporter of revisionist prisoners of conscience. And he's going to be talking on where does the movement go from here. We also have Julie Lake there, former BNP regional organiser, and her talk is going to be Bringing Everyone Together, Why Cooperation is Best. Max Musson, he's going to be there as well. He's the operations director and editor for Western Spring, and his talk is entitled Community Activism. And we also have Alex Davies, main organizer from National Action, and his speech is entitled Key Principles. And finally, we have Jez Turner, the chairman of the London Forum and the inspiration behind the Forum Network, and his speech is entitled No Time for Cowardice. The entrance fee will be £10, but it's free admission for those aged under 26. If you want to go, then call 07743129684. That's 07743129684. Or you can contact Jez directly at londonforum@yahoo.co.uk. And you can also find more details about that in the Daily Stormer forums in the book club forums. And there's lots more details about it there. And there's a thread there, so you can find more information about it. Also, if you can't make it, then don't worry too much about it, because we will be playing the audio from that on Monday for you here at Radio Aryan. Okay, that's got all the announcements out of the way. Dennis, how are you doing today? You were ill last week and we couldn't produce our podcast, but I'm hoping you're feeling better now. It certainly sounds like you were very ill last week from what I hear.
Yeah, I'm convinced that I had one of these African bugs, because it's certainly an illness that I'd never heard of before. It's been rampant going through places where the wife works, and it certainly went through my family, and it was quite vicious instant and then came back again later on. So it's something I want to look into eventually. There must be quite a number of these bugs coming over with all these migrants. I'm convinced, I really am. Other than that, I'm fine and looking forward to it.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there is. I mean, we know that there's been a big spike in diseases that we eradicated in Britain 100 years ago that are turning up in the schools. We know that we had that Ebola outbreak in Africa and that nurse that brought it back over here. And different races, they have completely different immunity systems, mm-hmm. and they're susceptible to different diseases, and different viruses incubated in them are going to mutate into forms that we haven't seen before. So I would be very worried for people that lived in cities where you know, where all these Africans are coming in and people from the Middle East, they're all going to be bringing in new diseases. And these ones at Calais, I mean, they're full of parasites as well, aren't they? They're full of nits,
that's right,
and scabies, and lice, and all these horrible things. And we know the Black Plague was brought in by these rats with lice on them. Probably a similar thing with these Negroes, pretty similar to the black rat.
Well, that's because, I mean, it reversed the other way. When we went around the world, we took our common cold. And obviously, you know, a lot of these African Indians, whoever, didn't have the immune system, and they felt it, you know.
Well, it cuts both ways. You know, whatever way you look at it, separation is the best way to be. Separation and segregation from these other races will keep us healthy, and it will keep them healthy.
So it's, exactly, not,
you know, it's just practical, really, isn't it?
It's common sense.
Schmidt, how are you doing today on this glorious autumnal day?
Well, here it's not that glorious, but I'm doing fine. Some books arrived in the mail today, which will serve as sources for my future presentations. And they arrived quite somewhat earlier than expected. So I'm in a good mood. Thanks.
Well, that's good to hear. We really enjoy these presentations. You get lots of supportive comments. And we're also working on this video presentations of yours as well, which is taking slightly longer than planned. But I have to admit that some of that is down to me trying to find the time to work on the audio. But it will eventually be done. And we can promise you it's going to be really good when it is finished. It's going to be really professional sounding and professional looking. But today, I believe you've got something a little bit different for us. From instead of concentrating on the actual Axis war heroes, I believe you're going to be concentrating on an incident that happened during World War II. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. There is a Knight's Cross recipient involved in this. Well, he got the Knight's Cross some days later after the incident. But you could say there's a German war hero involved here. But yes, the main subject is the Laconia incident. And it took place not too far from, and at the time, Marseille was having his great successes in Africa. Among the sources I used was a Deutsches U-Boot Museum online edition and a book called An Alle Wölfe Angriff by Franz Kurowski, dealing with the German submarines in World War II. Laconia was a British troop ship. Originally, it was built as an ocean liner, completed in 1921, but then at the beginning of World War II, it was converted into an armed merchant cruiser and then into a troop ship. This meant it was a war vessel, and it was armed with 8 6-inch cannons and 2 3-inch cannons. That's roughly 15 and 8 centimeter caliber. She was about 180 meters long, and that's about 600 feet. In 1942, under the command of Captain Rudolf Sharp, she was sailing from Cape Town in South Africa to Freetown in Sierra Leone, which was a British crown colony at the time. On the 12th of September, about midway between Ascension Island and Sierra Leone, she was spotted by the crew of the U-boat U-156 under the command of Korvettenkapitän Werner Hartenstein, who was on his fourth patrol of his career. He was already highly decorated at that point, having earned the German Cross in Gold and the Iron Cross of both classes. After approaching the vessel on an intercept course for a few hours on the surface, Hartenstein gave the order to submerge and, closing in further, observing through the periscope, they were able to identify the vessel as the RMS Laconia. Hartenstein ordered the torpedo tubes to be flooded and loaded, and the muzzle flaps to be opened. After the necessary calculations, Hartenstein ordered the torpedoes to be launched. Two torpedoes hit the Laconia, and at 22 minutes past 10 p.m., the Laconia radioed that she had been torpedoed and her position. Nobody but U-156 seems to have received that distress call and those that followed. Laconia was carrying 463 officers and crew, 256 British Army soldiers, 1,793 Italian prisoners of war, a different source says 1,809, and 103 Polish soldiers, which were the guards of the prisoners. As Laconia was thinking, the Italian prisoners were left locked up, but most were miraculously able to escape by breaking down hatches or climbing up ventilation shafts. I guess people can develop extraordinary strength and initiative when threatened by an otherwise certain horrible death. A lot of them were shot, however, when they appeared on deck, and even more bayoneted, stabbed to death with the bayonets mounted on the rifles by the Poles and the British soldiers. A lot of people had jumped into the water before all lifeboats were launched, and so there were boats with only a few passengers. When the Italians tried to climb aboard the life rafts, they were shot or their hands hacked off with axes. Somehow Italian POWs did manage to board one life raft, however. As you can imagine, the blood in the water soon attracted sharks. As Italian Corporal Dino Monte later recounted, sharks started among us, grabbing an arm, biting a leg. Other large beasts swallowed entire bodies, end quote. Meanwhile, U-156 surfaced to capture senior officers or acquire important documents. As they approached, cutting through the darkness with a searchlight, they were horrified to see so many people in the water, dead bodies and people struggling for their lives, civilians among them, even women and children, and Italian prisoners. Hartenstein immediately ordered a rescue operation and to fly the Red Cross flag. Laconia disappeared below the waves 23 minutes past 11 p.m., so she had managed to stay afloat for more than an hour after the attack. Hartenstein sent a coded radio message to Admiral Karl Dönitz, stating that he had sunk Laconia, giving the exact position, reporting that unfortunately 1,500 Italian POWs had been on board, that 90 of them had been fished out of the water, stating how much fuel and torpedoes they had left and requesting further orders. Two German U-boats and an Italian submarine were ordered to help pick up the survivors. Vichy France sent a cruiser and two other ships. U-156 was crammed with nearly 200 survivors, including five women, and another 200 were in lifeboats attached to the U-boat. At 6 o'clock in the morning of the next day, Hartenstein had the following message broadcast in plain English, uncoded. Quote, "If any ship will assist the shipwrecked Laconia crew, I will not attack, providing I am not being attacked by ship or air forces. I picked up 193 men, 4 degrees 53 minutes south, 11 degrees 26 minutes west, German submarine." The British in Freetown received that message, but 2 days later they passed on to the Americans only that Laconia had been torpedoed and that a British merchant ship was on the way to pick up survivors. No mention of the Germans rescuing the British, Poles and Italians. U-156, meanwhile, remained in position, and on the 15th, she was finally joined by the two German U-boats and the Italian submarine. These four vessels, with all these survivors on board, above and below deck, were slowly heading for the African coast to rendezvous with the Vichy France vessels. During the night, the submarines became separated, and on the 16th, at 11 o'clock 25 minutes, AM. U-156 was spotted by an American B-24 Liberator operating from a secret airbase on Ascension Island. The U-boat was traveling with a Red Cross flag draped across her gun deck. Hartenstein sent Morse code signals in English to the crew of the B-24 requesting assistance. A British officer also signaled to B-24. Quote, "RAF officers speaking from German submarine, Laconia, survivors on board, soldiers, civilians, women, children," end quote. The B-24 did not reply in any way and turned away, notifying their superiors about the shipwrecked survivors and the Red Cross flag. The American senior officer in charge, Captain Robert C. Richardson III, who was later promoted to general, ordered the B-24 to attack. The pilot turned back towards the U-boat and attacked with bombs and depth charges. One bomb landed among the lifeboats, killing dozens of the survivors. The U-boat itself was damaged, but not critically. However, because the battery started emitting gases, he had to order all non-crew to leave the ship, including the Italians, because there were not enough Tauchretter available. Tauchretter are emergency breathing sets, usually called escape sets in English. Hartenstein ordered the lifeboats to be cut loose and the survivors on deck to jump into the water and swim away as fast as possible. On his orders, the submarine submerged only slowly so as to not to drag down the survivors with them into the depth.
That's pretty shocking, isn't it, to be bombing survivors. The Germans are really honourable to be going to pick them up under the Red Cross flag. Do you know much about this Red Cross flag, Schmidt? Was this something that all the forces were involved in? Was this like if the British had seen Germans in the water, would they have put a Red Cross flag on and picked them up? If the Americans had seen British in the water, would they have picked them up under a Red Cross flag? Was this a generally accepted behavior of the powers at the time, do you know?
Well, I read a, I don't remember the exact publication, but it was something like International Court, something like that. And they said that this had been a war crime because, among other things, of the Red Cross flag. And I don't know whether the Allies used them much or whether Germans used them in other incidents like this. I don't even know if there was ever a similar incident like this. I might have to look that up and maybe report on this in another episode.
I think the general law of the sea is that if you see people in the water, you have to go and pick them up. This is a problem that we have in Europe at the moment, because when we see these stranded vessels filled up with Africans, the maritime law or the law at sea says that if you see a boat that's in distress, you have to go and rescue them. That's just the law. It's always been, regardless of what race or country they come from. And it would seem that even if you are at war with them, that if you see a boat that's at sea that's in distress, then you have to go and pick them up. You have to go and rescue them. That just seems to be the ruling on this. Dennis, have you got a comment you'd like to make on this before Schmidt continues?
Well, it's just that in a way, I'm not really surprised, because when I was doing the documentary, Adolf Hitler, the greatest story ever told, obviously, you know, atrocities which we'd never heard of before were being uncovered. And I'm quite sure there's many, many others also unheard of which have got away scot-free. And that annoys me, because these people who perpetrated these atrocities actually either did get decorated, as Schmidt just told us, or they got away scot-free. And it's frustrating, to say the least.
Well, it's the same behaviour that we saw with the bombing of Dresden, isn't it? They bombed Dresden, and then when the emergency services came out to rescue the people, they went and bombed them again. And this time, you've got this ship, this Laconia, which is already been hit, and then you've got the Germans that say, "Well, we'll take the part of the emergency services. We'll go and pick them up." And then you've got the Americans bombing them again. So these survivors that think, you know, well, we've just been rescued, suddenly they're being fired upon by their own side.
Can I just say as well, by the way, as you know, lately we've been hearing these reports of atrocities in Aleppo and calls for war crimes by the very same people who actually targeted German civilians in World War II. You know, it's just for some people to contemplate when the propaganda is going on that, you know, Britain have targeted civilians in the past, and all of a sudden they're taking the white hat stance with Putin.
Oh, it's just an incredible hypocrisy that we're seeing going on over there in the Middle East, and as well with attacking Mosul because it's got terrorists in it, that's fine. But if Russia goes and attacks Western Aleppo because it's got terrorists in it, oh, well, that's a war crime. Never mind the fact that the terrorists keep bombing the other side of Aleppo and hitting schools and hospitals, but that's all covered up. Yeah, it's terrible hypocrisy that we see, but yeah, as you say, Dennis, we should be expecting it after the hypocritical behaviour in the war.
Even this week, Britain have sent some advisors, inverted commas, to train the rebels, apparently, to attack ISIS. Now, make of that as you will.
I think all that training is just going to go and help ISIS, isn't it?
I would have thought so.
They're not going to fight against their brothers, are they? They're not as stupid as us white people are fighting against our brothers during the Second World War. The Muslims don't do that. They go.
Well, that was an official announcement this week, so.
Yeah. Schmidt, do you have a comment on that, or do you want to continue with your presentation?
Well, regarding Syria, there was this Swiss journalist who interviewed Assad the other day, maybe a week and a half ago or so. And he asked Assad about these barrel bombs that he used, allegedly, and it made it sound like this was the worst war crime that could be committed using barrel bombs. And Assad stayed very cool and asked him what his definition of a barrel bomb was, and how, if I remember correctly, how a barrel bomb was any worse than any other bomb. And that kind of shut the so-called journalist down for a bit. It's incredible how people are conned into thinking that the Syrians, or at least the Assad government, is committing all these horrible war crimes when there's actually no evidence for that. And even the alleged tortures and there's no evidence for that except very suspect people claiming it, paid for by these Arab Gulf states, usually. I mean, the reports about these tortures are paid for by the Arab Gulf states.
That's right.
Yeah, there's a lot of organisations over there. They claim to be these NGOs that are supposed to be neutral. And they're not neutral because they're all either paid by the Gulf states, or they're in the pay of Soros, or in the pay of these Jews. And the people, the actual Syrian people that support their government, that voted for their government, we never actually hear from them. We don't hear from them at all. It's just these white helmets that they've given this award to. I mean, they're funded by the West. So they're clearly not going to point out that the crimes that the rebels are carrying out, are they? You know, it's just, yeah. Anyway, we should probably get back to this Laconia incident, Schmidt. Please continue.
Very well. The pilots of the B-24 reported back to base that, quote, the sub rolled over and was last seen bottom up. Crew had abandoned ship and taken to surrounding lifeboats, end quote. That's, of course, not true. The U-156 was not sunk. The crew of the B-24 were later awarded medals for the supposed sinking of U-156 when all they did was kill shipwrecked survivors and damage U-156. The survivors in two of the lifeboats decided to go against Hartenstein's request that they stay in the area to be rescued by neutral Vichy French ships. They instead headed for the African coastline. One of them, with 68 people on board initially, reached the African coast 27 days later with only 16 survivors. The other one was rescued by a British trawler after 40 days at sea. Only 4 of the initial 52 were still alive. Now, all of this, to me personally, seems to be the result of the demonization of Germany and Germans in the Allied propaganda. I have no other explanation to offer. The other 3 submarines were unaware of the attack until the Italian one picked up survivors from the attack on U-156. Soon thereafter, the submarines received confirmation by radio message of the attack on U-156 and were asked for the number of rescued survivors. U-506 replied that they had 151, including 9 women and children. U-507 replied that they had 491, 15 of which were women and 16 children. On the 17th, the British in Freetown sent a message to Ascension Island telling the Americans that 3 French ships were on their way, but without telling them that they were on a rescue mission. The American officer in charge then apparently assumed they were on their way to invade the island, so the submarine hunting was called off and they prepared for an invasion. The Vichy French ships picked up 373 Italians, 70 Poles and 597 British, including 48 women and children. Colonel Baldwin, on behalf of all the British survivors, presented the rescuers with a letter that reads as follows, quote, "We, the undersigned officers of His Majesty's Navy, Army and Air Force, and of the Merchant Navy, and also on behalf of the Polish detachment, the prisoners of war, the women and children, wish to express to you our deepest and sincerest gratitude for all you have done. At the cost of very great difficulties for your ship and her crew, in welcoming us, the survivors of His Majesty's transport ship, the Laconia." End quote. All in all, of the 2,732 people on board the Laconia when it was attacked, only 1,113 survived. 1,420 of the 1,619 who died were Italian prisoners of war. As a consequence of these actions by the Allies, Admiral Dönitz issued a standing order, Triton Null, which was later generally called the Laconia Order. It forbade German U-boat crews from taking survivors of enemy warships on board, except important officers or engineers. Even after the order was issued, however, German U-boat commanders still provided aid to survivors occasionally. At the Nuremberg trials, Dönitz, the legitimate German head of state at the time, was indicted for war crimes, especially because of the Laconia order. The defense team for Dönitz was able to clearly prove that the US had practiced unrestricted submarine warfare in the Pacific from day one on, and so did the British. Even Chester William Nimitz, US fleet admiral, testified. Yet, as we know, Dönitz was condemned to 10 years in prison. Evidence clearly mattered very little at the Nuremberg trials, as we can see again. I would like to end by reading a letter from a relative of one of the casualties of the Laconia incident to Horst Bredow of the Deutsche U-Boot Museum. Dear Mr. Bredow, U-156 sinking of Cunard liner Laconia, 12th of September 1942. I feel that I must write to you in view of the information which has come to light during the Battle of the Atlantic commemoration ceremony here in Liverpool during May of this year. My uncle, who was the bosun of the Laconia, did not survive its sinking. At that time, our family were merely informed that the ship had been torpedoed and sunk in the South Atlantic and that Uncle Willie had been lost. My father, who is now 84 years of age, had himself been the quartermaster on the Laconia, but had left her to join another ship some years prior to her sinking. 51 years later, during the Battle of the Atlantic Commemoration Week, I happened by chance to see one of the survivors of the Laconia interviewed on television. This gentleman told how the U-boat captain had surfaced and taken his lifeboat under tow, having provided the survivors with food and water. So unlikely did this seem that I decided at this point to make some inquiries and discover the truth for myself. My search led me initially to a retired Royal Naval Submarine Commander attached to our local Royal Navy Association. He not only confirmed the survivor story, but allowed me to see an account of the incident in a book entitled Wolf Packs, which had been presented to the Liverpool RNA in 1990. By visiting German U-boat veterans. He also obtained on my behalf much information concerning the commander of U-156, Commander Werner Hartenstein. From there, I continued my search in our local reference library, where I found a book entitled U-Boats to the Rescue, the Laconia Incident, by a French naval historian, Lance Bayard, I believe this name is pronounced. This book, together with other information which I managed to obtain, completely changed my opinion of the German submarine service and the German people as a nation. The purpose of this letter, therefore, is to say a very long overdue and sincere thank you on behalf of myself and my family for the considerable efforts made by Commander Hartenstein, Commanders Hartenstein, U-156, Würdemann, U-506, and Schacht, U-507, and their crews to rescue the survivors from Laconia. Nobody could possibly have asked more of these men than they gave. They were men of whom Germany can be justifiably proud, and they should be remembered by everyone as men of honor. It is with deep regret that I learned that none of these U-boats survived the war. If by chance any member of their crew are still alive and known to you, I would respectfully ask that you inform them on behalf of myself and my family that we shall remember them in future with respect rather than with contempt. I regret that I cannot say the same for the pilot and crew of the American Liberator aircraft, which repeatedly attacked U-156, which was clearly engaged in a mission of mercy. It strikes me as very sad that it has taken 51 years to learn the truth about the Laconia incident. Why the families in question were not informed of the commendable actions of the German U-boat crews is not clear. Possibly it was an oversight, or, on the other hand, maybe it was considered that to show the German submarine service in a good light at the time might have gone in some way to destroy the propaganda campaign, which appears to have been so carefully constructed. The trouble with propaganda is, of course, that it continues to be believed long after the conflict has ended. At least some of us now see it for what it was. It does appear that a number of the survivors have, over the years, tried to make the true events of 12th of September 1942 known, and I enclose a copy of a letter to the journal Sea Breezes, dating from 1954, which I came across in my literature search. During Battle of the Atlantic week, I also met another survivor from the Laconia who had traveled many miles to Liverpool to tell his story. He was apparently only 14 and a half years of age when the ship was torpedoed, and he vividly remembers the kindness extended to him by Commander Hartenstein. He is aware that I am writing to you and wishes me to also pass on his gratitude. I hope that you will not object to my having written to you. I've tried for some weeks to find out to whom I should address my letter. In the end, Mr. Paul Hedgecock, RNR, provided me with your name and address. I wish you well, Mr. Bredow, as Paul tells me that you are not in the best of health. Please be assured that the German submarine veterans whom you represent have grown very considerably in stature here in Liverpool in recent weeks. The Battle of the Atlantic commemoration ceremony had very much in mind your tremendous losses as well as our own. Yours sincerely, Carol Patton, Mrs.
Well, it would have been anti-Semitic to put the Germans in a positive light, wouldn't it? You couldn't give them credit for doing anything good. Whoever does that would be accused of being anti-Semitic. Now, that's apparently the way that things stand now. If Ken Livingstone says that speaks the truth and says Hitler helped the Jews move to Israel, that's anti-Semitic because it's portraying Adolf Hitler in a positive light. So I think that's the reason why the truth wasn't told about it. But think how decent these Germans are. They've been told not to go and pick the survivors up because the ship might or the submarine might get attacked, and yet they still carried on doing that. And it's interesting that you brought up the Nuremberg trial there, where they tried to say that Donitz was a barbarian for giving out this order. And when they did that, they inadvertently let slip that the Americans have been doing that right since the beginning of the war. They've been engaging in unrestricted submarine warfare right since the beginning of the war. So we see again that the Allies were conducting the war according to a completely different rule book to the Germans. The Germans were keeping to the treaties and the established rules of war that had been established before. And the Americans and the British threw all that out the window and just broke all those laws, targeted civilians, firebombed cities in Germany. And then at the end of it all, did something that had never been done before in history and put the vanquished in a courtroom to be judged by the victors, which goes against every precedent in law that's ever been known. And yet still today, people think that people that are unaware of this sort of information think that there was nothing wrong with the Nuremberg trials. They don't think any further than the propaganda that they are taught. That's a really interesting story there, Schmidt. I'm very glad that you brought that to us today. Thank you for that. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
Yeah, you've hit on a sore subject with me with the Nuremberg trials. I mean, it's an easy get out for a lot of people, and a lot of people have been fooled by it, are still being fooled by it, and it's just something that had never happened before in wartime. No leadership of any country at war had been taken to task, and obviously the evidence was either fabricated or made up. Stalin himself wanted just to shoot everybody, as Stalin would, but it's a little bit more calculated from the Freemasons. They wanted something in the history books, to so where they could, you know, future relatives could fall back on, and just to hang a person makes that picture just makes him out to be a criminal. So yeah, you just hit on a bit of a sort on a raw nerve with me.
Well, this is the thing with those Nuremberg trials. I mean, that's what people say, isn't it? They say, oh, yes, but it was established in the Nuremberg trials, yeah, that they gassed millions of Jews. Of course, when you look into it, you find that that the actual laws of evidence weren't applied. The people that were giving testimonies had been tortured. Their families had been threatened. The witnesses were shown to be lying. And the defence weren't actually given anything that they could use to defend themselves with. No, they were told they could only use the prosecution documents. It's just shocking when you look into that. If anyone is interested in that, I recommend the David Irving book on the Nuremberg trials, which goes into great detail. And there's also a book which Simon Shepherd has over at Heretical Press. I can't recall the title of that one right now. Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Schmidt. Hopefully, we're going to hear more of your Axis War Hero series in the future. But we've got some Allied war heroes that I believe you're going to talk about today, Dennis. The British Free Corps, is that right?
Yes. Found some more information about these guys. Obviously, I used John Amery as a avatar. So I thought, you know, it would be interesting to a little bit more deeper, because there's a lot of secrecy about it. And it's just a little bit more light on it. And I hope people enjoy it. Obviously, men joined the ranks of the SS from most of the European countries, especially after the preemptive strike on Bolshevik-occupied Russia and the Führer's much publicized crusade against Bolshevism. There is a number of people in Britain who know about it. And again, you know, any figures have been kept well down. Any volunteers signed up for a 2-year term with German citizenship granted at the end of their service, and over 1 million non-German nationals enlisted in the SS throughout Europe. The volunteers came from Holland, Belgium, Denmark, Norway, Switzerland, Finland, Croatia, Ukraine, Latvia, Hungary, Spain, Sweden, and many other ethnic groups, including the White Russians and the Cossacks. Well, one seldom mentioned the band of volunteers that were formed from the British, known as the British Free Corps, the BFC. This was the brainchild of John Amery, who was the eldest son of the Secretary of India, of British government. His father, the Right Honourable Leopold Amory, MP. John Amory had fought against communism in the Spanish Civil War, where he gained Spanish citizenship. After the conflict, he moved to France and subsequently to Germany in 1942, from where he broadcast radio messages to Britain calling for peace between Britain and Germany. And I'd like to remind everybody at this point that Adolf Hitler was the only leader in the World War II to call for peace. None of the Allied leaders even considered it. Amory founded firstly the League of St. George, which was to be a non-combat unit made of British prisoners of war to spread the National Socialist message to fellow prisoners of war, this alternative to this Jewish financial system, which keeps us all locked down as we know today. When the Wehrmacht High Command insisted on the Legion being a combat unit, then John Amory formed an offshoot, the British Anti-Bolshevik League, aptly named, I would think. And January 1944, the 1st of January, the BFC was officially formed with the out of these two groups. And the volunteers signed a pledge which read, "I, Joe Bloggs, being a British subject, consider it my duty to offer my services to the common European struggle against communism and hereby apply to enlist in the British Free Corps." Interestingly, before the BFC came into being, a number of British volunteers had already fought in some of the SS units, the Totenkopf, May 1940. Waffen SS Manpower Reports mentions British volunteers serving in both the Totenkopf and the Standarten units. Many writers hostile to the BFC have claimed in the past its members never actually saw active service, but this is an out-and-out lie. Reproduced in a full letter from Anthony Bears, who lived in Surrey, and was printed in the Daily Express, and the letter read, "Anthony Beevor, inside Hitler's concrete tomb last week, mentions the foreign SS troops who helped to defend Berlin. Among them were soldiers of the British Free Corps who were released from prisoners of war camps in return for donning German SS uniforms, with the understanding that they would be asked to fight, be asked to fight their own countrymen. As a national serviceman stationed in Berlin, I met a Russian Red Army officer who was impressed by the fighting spirit of 8 misguided British soldiers he came across. They'd held up an entire Russian regiment for almost 2 days until they ran out of ammunition. Only 2 survived to surrender and were promptly shot by the understandably irritated Russians, or should we say Soviets, who had lost almost 100 men and 3 tanks. The Russian officer said that the unit, especially a soldier identified only as Mr. Pleed, had they been fighting the Germans, they would have deserved the Victoria Cross. He told me, I hope the British invented a good story for their families. For as brave a soldier is, still a brave soldier, even when a traitor to his country. Soldier Reginald Cornfield is thought to be the only British Free Corps member to be killed in action. On the 27th of May 1945, during the Battle of Berlin, Cornfield disabled a Soviet tank with a Panzerfaust. The tank crew then tracked him down, shot him dead. And due to this unusual BFC uniform, his identity book was taken and kept by a Soviet officer. Nothing else is recorded of the soldier named Pleed. John Amory's book, England and Europe, was distributed to British prisoners of war from the 21st of April 1943 in the hope that they would join the Legion of St. George. Many of these British soldiers were kept in the dark for the real truth about World War II. And this probably went a long way for at least some soldiers to understand. The book was vehemently anti-communist. The unique work details such things as what happened to the general population of countries when communism, or rather Bolshevism, takes over, who instigated the war, and who was likely to profit from such a war. England and Europe also warns, the book England of Europe, of course, also warns that Britain could lose her empire, in fact would lose her empire, to the benefit of both the Soviets and the USA. And one of the first two volunteers was, one of the first volunteers was a guy called Frank Wood. You've got to understand that a lot of these names were fake, many pseudonyms, and obviously for repercussions after it probably was a good thing. And this Frank Wood drafted a recruitment leaflet for the BFC, which was dropped by the Luftwaffe to the British frontline troops fighting in Italy. The leaflet reads as follows: "Fellow countrymen, we of the British Free Corps are fighting for you. We are fighting with the best of Europe's youth to preserve our European civilization, our common cultural heritage, from this menace of Jewish communism. Make no mistake about it. Europe does include England. Should Soviet Russia ever overcome Germany and other European countries fighting with her, nothing on this earth will save the continent from communism, and our own country sooner or later would eventually succumb. We are British, we love England and all it stands for. Most of us have fought on the battlefields of France, of Libya, Greece and of Italy, and many of our best comrades have in arms are lying there, sacrificed in this war of Jewish revenge. We felt then that we were being lied to and betrayed. Now we know it for certain. This conflict between England and Germany is racial suicide. We must unite, take up arms against this common enemy. We ask you to join with us in our struggle. We ask you to come into our ranks, fight shoulder to shoulder with us for Europe and for England." Published by the British Free Corps. Which was quite a heartfelt plea, would have obviously fallen a lot of deaf ears because of the propaganda circulated in this country. But nonetheless, it was a true heartfelt plea.
Yeah, I would have just said, was just going to say, most of the people were just blockheads and didn't pay too much attention to it. You know, they were too busy singing these ridiculous songs about Hitler only having one ball and things like that. Yeah, you know, I think most of the British people at the time wouldn't pay any attention to what was being said. You know, you had Oswald Mosley speaking out against it, William Joyce speaking out against it, lots of people speaking out against the war, but people just didn't take any notice. And how could they call those brave boys traitors? When you listen to that oath that they took, the oath to defend Europe against communism with other European youth, there's nothing in that that says we pledge to fight for Germany or we pledge to fight against Britain. It's purely and simply to fight against communism. Now this was the same thing with the Latvian Legion. All they fought against were the communists, the advancing Bolshevik hordes, and they were actually absolved of being a part of the SS or fighting against the Allies. They were absolved of that. So why were the British Free Corps not absolved of fighting against the Allies when their oath specifically states that they're only going to be fighting against communism? And you've also got the Germans confirming that no way would these British fighters be asked to fight against Britain, which they clearly wouldn't do. And there's there's very little about this that's available. I'd like to read John Amery's book. Do you know if that's available online at all, Dennis?
I don't actually know. I mean, that's a good one because, like I said, a lot of it is shrouded in mystery. Nothing really is ever put out which is favourable to people who fight for the Third Reich. So you don't even know what's been said. What little has been said is true anyway. So, yeah, you're right. And that's maybe a quick look around the internet will find that book, yeah.
And I mean, they must have been trustworthy as well. I mean, this shows you that National Socialism was based on the truth, because the prisoners of war, the British prisoners of war, they would give them this information, and then if they agreed to fight for the British Free Corps, then they would free them. Basically, they would trust them not to to attack Germany on the side of Britain. They would trust them. You know, did anything like that happen in Britain? Did Britain take German prisoners of war and convince the Germans that Britain's way was right and that the Germans should be fighting on the Britain side? I don't think they did. And if they did, there's no way they would have trusted the Germans, because there was no real ideology that Britain was fighting for. I mean, what do they say? They're fighting to preserve democracy. Hitler was put in power by a vote. He had the support of popular support of 90% of the country. 99% in Austria supported the merging of Austria and Germany. So how could they say they were fighting to preserve democracy when Churchill hadn't been put in power through a democratic vote? He'd just been appointed as the prime minister for the war. At the end of the war, he wasn't voted in. The people voted against him, as it were. And yet today, we've now got new plastic £5 notes with this traitor Churchill on the back that destroyed half of Europe and lost us the British Empire. And he also shot Welsh miners. You know, we've just got this fat traitor on the back of our £5 notes. I would suggest that that's a good chance for people to bring up this subject. When they get handed a £5 note, bring up the subject that why is Churchill on the back there when he destroyed half of Europe and lost us our empire?
Yeah, and a big fan of Krudenov Kalergi, of course.
Yeah, obviously you can go into more details, and apparently he used to wear women's underwear. He was drunk all the time. He was a coward. He wouldn't stay in London. He goaded Hitler into sending an air force into Britain and then made certain that he wasn't there in London and pretended that he was there. You know, I mean, the guy was just despicable when you think about it. And he's put forward as a British hero.
Yeah, well, like I said early on, a lot of things rankle me, and that is another one. I mean, I know people who, you know, have said to me, Churchill would never let this happen today, and if they only knew. But, you know, such is life. Who said life is fair? I'll tell you what is interesting, though. These guys were pretty clued up about the racial facts of it all. And, you know, the little line there, this conflict between England and Germany is racial suicide. Because Krudenov Kalergi looked on, and of course saw the Freemasons and the Jews also, look on this northern part of Europe, which dominated by this, you know, the white race, the Anglo-Saxon, the Aryan. And he looked at them, actually. I saw some information on him recently, that they were just barbaric, with no culture. And any culture that they ever did have, they stole from the southern tribes, the races. And so Churchill is very much of this opinion that the white race must end. And these soldiers are actually aware of this racial conflict. I'm not sure that many in Britain were, because when Hitler would turn around and say he'd never wanted to fight the British, he let 300,000 go at Dunkirk. These were Anglo-Saxons. He didn't want to kill unnecessarily. And this is all these guys were pretty clued up, I think.
Well, he knew that, as you say, he knew that we were their racial brothers. I mean, if you look back in the oldest chronicle that we have, the Chronicles of England, which go back before the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and that tells us that we came from Brutus, who was a Trojan. So the British people, that's what the Trojans look like. And you can take it, you can go on from there to the expansion of the tribes and the migration of the tribes. You've got this tribe that became the Cymry, and they went to Denmark, Daneland. They became the Norsemen. They also became the Anglo-Saxons, and they were also in Helvetia in Switzerland, Schmidt's part of the world. And they were all the same people, even when they came back as Normans into Britain. It was this same racial group, Nordic looking, maybe with darker hair, but they were the original ones that were in Asia Minor, in the Phoenician civilization and the Trojan civilization, the really early ones, sort of going back 3,000-4,000 years, maybe before that. And these migrations, they were the same people. It was just over a spread of time that the language changed. Obviously, you would get a particular look to these people, where the just by selective breeding, they would look slightly different, but they were essentially all the same race. And the whole of Northern Europe was essentially the same race. And the Germans realized this. Obviously, the British Free Corps realized this as well through their propaganda there.
Well, I think it goes even further. I'm sure you'll agree that not just the looks of that race, but the actual feelings of that race, because whereas, you know, the Jew wakes up every day and thinks, how can I cheat you know, my fellow guy, you know, the white race wasn't of that mentality. They're quite compassionate. Even in Christianity, help thy neighbor. And so even, you know, the actual things they thought and how they went about things is totally different than these people that the British Army were conned, know the word, into fighting for. Amazing, really.
Oh yeah, the racial soul is different for all the different races. I mean, you'd have to be pretty mad to think that if something looks different, it's going to be exactly the same. Form and function are intimately connected. So if one object looks different to another object, then its function is going to be different to another object. And if you've got one race that looks completely different from another race, it's going to think differently, it's going to act differently. You know, our body language is going to be different. Our ways of treating people courteously are going to be different. I mean, British people are known to always queue. And then you've got others like Africans who will always push in front in the queue. They have no tradition of queuing. It's always, you know, if you can barge your way to the front first, then do that. You've got totally yeah. different set of manners and courtesy, which just causes problems when you mix the two together. I mean, diversity has caused nothing but trouble and strife throughout all history. We have to separate, and we have to keep ourselves segregated from these other races for their good and for ours, like we were discussing at the beginning of the podcast, Dennis. And we're fairly sort of coming near to the end now, I think. Do you want to let people know where they can find your work before we finish?
Yeah, The Great Story Never Told, still one of the most popular DVDs on the internet, is available at thegreatestorynevertold.tv. People still want to buy it, even though it's free on the internet. And come in and buy the back door. You can find on the YouTube channel, on my YouTube channel of Dennis Wise, and hopefully it's going to be out for before Christmas. I'd just like to say, I don't now think there's going to be a part 22. I may add to the series later on down the line, but at this moment in time, we're just looking at the next thing to come out about it is The Sources, and hopefully it'll be on sale before Christmas.
Well, that'd be great if you can get a copy of that so that people can give that out to their friends and family over Christmas. I know I'll definitely be buying one. The Greatest Story Never Told is I've seen that at least half a dozen times and lent that out to people. But yeah, we'll be back obviously next week at the same time, same place with a live edition. And just before we go, I'll remind people we do have a Radio Aryan Facebook page now. You can find us on the TuneIn app. You can find us on Audio Now if you're in America. Calls 641-793-9434. And don't forget that it's also the Southwest Forum in Bristol tomorrow on Saturday. So we hope you have a great weekend. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you all again next time.
To Radio Aryan.